You are listening to station WGN.
Oh, a microphony!
And a phony at the mic! Yeah.
Whoa! And radio became an accepted vehicle for nationwide news and opinion.
Notify all radio and TV stations to broadcast the following message.
Oh, is that the comedy spot?
No, Bubblehead, this is a comedy spot.
You're a fun guy, Dave. You're lonely on an island.
What a dope. What a maroon.
Quiet, please. In exactly 15 seconds, we'll be on the air.
This is exciting, isn't it?
5, 4, 3, 2.
And now, live from the Allstate Skyline Studios, here's Dave.
All right, glad you could be with us on this Father's Day morning. Joining me in studio has been our tradition on this day is my oldest son, Josh. Josh, good morning to you, buddy.
Good morning, Dad.
And good morning to you, Roger Badish.
Well, good morning to the Pliers.
Happy Father's Day to you, buddy.
Why, thank you very much.
Curtis, good morning to you as well.
Thank you. Good morning to you.
Happy Father's Day as well. You have a little announcement to make?
I do. Oh, besides Happy Father's Day, of course. I was going to say, I'm not a dad.
Okay, so. All right. That's what I was asking. All right. Good to know. Yeah, you know what? I was just thinking today, you know, it's we're going to hang out the family today and do something fun. And yeah, cold everywhere. Like, yeah. Josh was like, you know, what are we going to wear today? We were thinking about doing a couple different things. You know, there's Rib Fest in Chicago.
There's Taco Fest
right in Pilsen.
And then there's Summer Fest, Polish Fest.
Yes, up in the Summerfest grounds is Polish Fest, which we've done every year. But I remember most years going sweltering heat.
Right.
And it's going to be now at the lakefront, they said upper 40s at the lakefront up in Milwaukee.
In Milwaukee, north,
yeah.
Sure.
It's kind of crazy, so yeah. I'm not quite sure. What are you going to do today? Roger Badish for Father's Day.
I've got a 12-hour turnaround between shifts, so we won't be doing anything today, but
tomorrow.
Monday,
yeah, what are you doing?
We're heading up to Gale Street Inn.
Oh, nice.
Kids are taking me out for dinner.
Ribs?
And, well, I don't know if I'm going to have the ribs. I know they will.
Okay.
But I'm going to see if they got a nice skirt steak on the menu.
Easy.
Is
that code?
I love skirt steak.
You know, it's funny. Nick went there last night for dinner.
Yeah, I know.
Because he does that. And we might end up there tonight. It is kind of a tradition. But I think this is his busiest tonight. Gale Street Inn, we're talking about
Father's
folks.
Father's Day, yeah.
Busiest night of the year.
Probably.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a guy's thing. I'm going to get some ribs.
Yeah.
You know, he usually throws grills outside. And hopefully it doesn't rain for him. But he usually throws some grills out there. And he's grilling ribs out there.
Out in the back?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you got to maintain. You got to keep up.
It's packed.
Yeah. You got to
keep
up. Yeah.
In fact, we had a call.
Yeah.
Because I thought at one point, we haven't been there in about a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so the kids were
saying.
Shameful. Huh?
Shameful.
Oh, I know. But there's so many different places that we like to go eat.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, you know, for a while they were saying, you know, we keep going to Gale Street Inn. Can we try something different for a while? And I said, okay, whatever, you know, blah, 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 blah. And so then this time they said, where'd you like to go eat? I said, yeah, we haven't been to Gale Street.
Yeah.
Let's go.
Yeah.
And they
absolutely
love the ribs there.
Sure.
And so that's what we're going to do. But our daughter had a call to make sure they'd be open Monday. Because I think in the past they used to be closed on either Monday or Tuesday. It's Tuesday?
Okay. We know.
So, he knows.
Yeah, we're not regulars. Not at all. Hey, by the way, great show today. I'm really excited about this. So Rich Coase and Jim Roach, who's his executive producer, is going to be in studio with Josh and I and be talking about today is his 40th anniversary as Svengoolie, which is so cool. He did have Triumph the Insult Comic Dog on last night. We're going to play a little of that clip as well. We also, it's the 85th anniversary of The Stooges. It's back on MeTV. We're going to talk a little bit about that because I think it was about 5 years ago that Rich and I together interviewed Joan Maher, who is Mo Howard's daughter.
Mm-hmm.
She's in her 90s today, but she's been the one carrying the torch of The Stooges, writing books. And there's an auction house right now that's auctioning off which I think came from his daughter, Mo's personal collection. So it's his scripts with his notes in it. I mean, think about this stuff.
He's
85, 90 years old.
Just amazing.
Remember the alphabet song that they sang?
Yes.
B-A-B-E-B-B-I-B-I. Exactly.
Yep.
The sheet music to that going on auction.
No way.
Yeah, I mean, you think about this is really kind of legendary stuff that's going on the auction block.
And you know, that we know their TV stuff, but they were hot before TV, or well, the films.
The films were on in the right. movie theater before TV.
Right,
they just
but
ended
they
up
did
there.
Stage shows.
Yes, they did.
Before the films.
Yeah.
And they were hot on stage.
Oh, they would be. They toured Chicago. They toured Milwaukee. They were all over the place. So we're going to talk a little bit about that.
Okay.
Author Tom Miller, a new book called Seeking Chicago, will do that. Shawnee will be in for history. So got a great show planned. So here's a little something, because I was looking at like all of our ages here today. And,
I'm the oldest.
No, it's true. But in the last 2 years, millennials have become the largest generation in the U.S. workforce.
What?
Millennials are also the fastest growing generation of customers in the marketplace. And there's been studies done, obviously. And everybody, anytime you see a young person, we call them a millennial. That's not
They're
really
not
the
all
case.
Millennials,
Josh
are they?
Is not a millennial. He's a Gen Z.
A who?
A Gen Z. That's Generation easy. Z.
Okay.
No, he's Generation Z. but Gen, you know, you got to look out, because millennials, Gen Z has arrived, and they're very different from millennials. You know, we talk about millennials and their high expectations and all this other stuff. Gen Z is completely different from them, and I've got some cool stats. But so just to break this down, my father, which was born in who was born in 1940, and my mother, they're called traditionalists, or the silent generation, and that is born in 1945 and before.
45 and before.
Oops,
okay. All right.
That's
now
the last,
that's not part of the greatest generation.
Greatest generation was a nickname of those who were alive during the war year. No, it's before that. No, it's before that.
Yeah.
This is the silent generation, the traditionalists. Baby boomers are
that's
46
me.
To 64. That's you.
Yeah.
I'm Generation X, which is 65 to 76. Millennials are 77 to 95. So now...
that's a big gap there.
It is. And then 96 to today is Gen Z.
Okay.
But a lot of people refer to, like, my son's generation as...
Oh, you're just a millennial.
You're a millennial. Well, you're not a millennial.
But right. Why do they group them all together? Because they're younger?
Easier. Well, yeah, and it's kind of become a thing for our generation, yours and mine, to be like, those damn millennials. We've lumped everybody into that bucket.
Yeah.
And it's not that millennials suck, Curtis. That's not what we're saying.
I'm the exception.
You are the exception. You kind of defy some of the logic on who millennials versus Gen Z.
He's got an old soul.
Yeah. But Gen Z are decidedly different. They're more pragmatic than millennials. Gen Zs are more realistic when it comes to jobs, job opportunities available in the market. For example, they're also less likely to take risks. Like millennials, I don't want to say they don't care, but they're more likely to be, you know, walk right into the boss's office and say, you know, hey, I want a, you know, $20,000 raise, and I want a desk by the window, and, you know, I don't care. If I lose my job, I lose my job. But, oh, by the way, the job I want has a great coffee bar, and I'm really excited about this coffee bar, and I'm going to work there over this place because their amenities are much better here. Gen Z wants more job security. They want stability in their jobs and their finances.
Kind of like coming back around to the boomers who wanted security. Actually, before the boomers.
Yeah.
Our parents, coming back from the war, they wanted the job security in order to raise their suburban families.
Three key trends that shape generations are parenting, technology, and economics. For example, many baby boomers have the parenting philosophy of, we want it to be easier for our kids than it was for us. And this philosophy, in turn, helped create and reinforce millennial sense of entitlement. Which is a highly
everybody
debated,
gets an award.
Yeah, look at Curtis is looking like, shove it up your. but Gen Z is known for being entrepreneurial, and I said that to Josh in the car on the way up here, and he's like, "Yeah, I can see that."
Oh,
right?
Definitely.
Yeah, your spending habits have been shaped by growing up in the wake of the recession. See, now think about that. It's all about when you grew up. So we grew up, my generation. You know, we were the ones buying houses, being upside down on houses, and so forth. Seeing their parents and their teachers live through harder times, they're more practical. And it says here that teens are making, especially in the Gen Z, and I found this very interesting because Josh had a long conversation with my dad last night about, they're making a fortune selling old clothes. They're more entrepreneurial in the event that if they need to make money, they might not go out and have a job. Remember, we were talking some weeks ago about teens in this generation mm-hmm. have less jobs at this time. They're doing right. more educational stuff, sports mm-hmm. stuff. Mm-hmm. But they find millennials don't find ways to make money. Gen Z does. They will find side ways to do it. Because you yeah. were telling my dad about selling stuff.
Well, there's either like the thrift market where you'll go and you'll find some hidden gold at a store. But then there's also the resale kind of way where people will go and buy shoes, clothing, whatever, etc., that are on sale at a certain amount for only a certain amount sold. They'll buy it and then they'll resell at a much, much greater value.
So you're just finding ways to make money.
Correct.
And so you're just thinking through how you can make the biggest bang for the buck. Because like the millennials, they say they like their brand products, but they will go buy at full retail price. Josh, when he sees a pair of shoes, mm-hmm. he'll go to a second hand and buy them for $20 yeah. as opposed to $150 or $120.
Oh, right.
And then he cleans them. This is what I found fascinating, too, is like he takes these white gym shoes, like let's say some Nikes or whatever, and he creates like the Chicago flag and he paints them and then he gives them as gifts to his friends and mm-hmm. stuff like that. But that's a lot more cost effective, and you're putting more artistic time into it than you
Correct.
Are money.
Personalizing.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, what they're doing, it sounds like they're making new markets.
Yeah.
Establishing new customers for new markets.
Definitely.
Yeah.
It says here that Gen Z and millennials are close in age, but they don't necessarily value the same things. 60% of Gen Z prefer cool products over experiences. But 77% of millennials prefer the opposite. They want experiences. So how do you feel about that, Curtis?
I'm kind of the same way. I do like a cool gadget. You know, like I don't have an Apple Watch, but I think it'd be kind of cool to have one. You know, like, you know, those nifty sort of things. But I am more about the experience, especially, you know, in this career that I'm in, you know, mm-hmm. especially in any sort of media industry, you have to have the experience and the hard work and the work ethic to go behind that.
Yeah.
When you want to get higher up in this industry that we're all in. And I don't see that a lot with a lot of other millennials.
No,
like work ethic wise.
You are different that way. Yeah. Millennials spend much of their childhoods without social media or smartphones, where Gen Zs don't know a world before mobile technology.
Oh, yeah.
I remember telling my, my sister-in-law when she was young, when she was your age, Josh, that, I said something like, you know, before VCRs and DVD players, she goes, when was that? Like we were in the Stone Age at some point during this whole thing. Millennials mostly grew up in a healthy economic times, but now poorer than their parents, where Gen Zs grew up learning how to be frugal. So there's just a little bit of a change between both those as well. While millennials were able to go through their childhoods without giving much thought to the then healthy economy, teenage Gen Zs are already concerned about it. Like they're thinking right now about, I don't want to have student loan debt. Like that, they're worried about that now. And I know Josh is very conscious about that. But then there's another generation, especially when we talk about the election and you know, we want our college tuition paid for. I don't want to say everyone, all millennials are looking for a free ride, but they're looking for a free ride, where Josh doesn't look for a free ride necessarily, but he's concerned about paying for it. Like there's just some differences in philosophy on this. Millennials were most likely to work a traditional team job, and this is where we talked about the shoes and stuff. Gen Zs are most likely to earn money from a side, they're calling it side hustle.
Yeah. Oh.
Which is that, which is just coming up with your own... Gen Z is more connected to interests and cultures around the world than millennials were in their teens. Millennials tended to believe that a college education was worth it, even if it meant student debt. Gen Zs are worried about student loans in this whole thing. I'm trying to see what else we have. Gen Zs are more about showing off their individuality, and millennials are more about loving their brands. So
Starbucks. Well, you just described showcasing the artistic side with Josh's shoes and how he paints like the Chicago flag on it. Oh, yeah. And millennials are notoriously known for sticking to their brands, whether it be Dunkin' Ice Coffee or Starbucks or what have you.
That's the statement.
Adidas and all that sort
of stuff. But that's a statement that you're making when you're holding that in your hand, right?
Yeah, uh-huh.
And Josh cares less about the brand and just wants it to be like, and I'm not just saying this to you, you and Gen Z is,
sure,
it's all about you.
yeah.
No, no, I mean, it's all about your individuality,
right,
and showing a little bit about you.
Personal.
What, so our daughter was born in 78.
Mm-hmm.
So she would be in what group again?
Millennial.
That's millennial?
You said it's millennial started at 76.
Okay.
Yeah.
And our son was born in 88.
So mm-hmm. they'd both be millennial.
Yeah, both millennials.
Yeah, both millennials.
Two of the most different millennials
Sure. This I found really interesting, too. Many millennials supported marriage equality in Barack Obama, but they tended to be adverse to political parties. Gen Zs tend to be more social justice-oriented than millennials and not necessarily as liberal as the millennials are. And because you see that and you hear it about in colleges all the time, and I won't say exactly what Josh was mentioning today, but he said, how come some groups get a day, but some other groups get a month? Like when you're celebrating their heritage or whatever, why isn't it all equalized a little bit? But that was his point to me, is that, okay, you know, this group gets a month, but mm-hmm. how come veterans only get Veterans Day? Like it's very interesting, just his philosophy on all that stuff. More Gen Zs are exploring new gender norms or discarding gender altogether than previous generations. Yeah, kind of interesting, huh?
Yeah.
And then, you know, we just grew up a little bit differently, but I think you're right about the fact that baby boomers, you know, coming out after the war, you know, some in the early parts, you know, being frugal about their lifestyle. Mm-hmm. But then after the war, there was just, you know, the suburbs and jobs and cars mm-hmm. and everything else. But you're right. I think we're cycling through it again, Roger.
I think so.
Yeah.
It's because there are some parts of the old ways. We'll group all that together in old ways.
Yeah.
That hold true through the generations that I think all of society favors in yeah. one form or another. So you can call it whatever you want.
Yeah.
But it's still the same thing, and there are, I think, through trial and error, newer things that come along that either get, oh, hey, this works,
yeah,
or, this doesn't work so much, let's forget that and let's move on to something else.
True. Very
so,
true.
Yeah.
There you have it. There you have it. Josh, what are we going to be talking about after the news here? TV dads?
TV dads.
Best TV dads. So if you want to tell us who you think you're, who's your favorite TV dad, call us or text us 312-981-7200. We're going to be doing that after the news next on 720 WGN.
Kent, the only cigarette with a micronite filter. Kent Regular and the new king-size Kent present the story of a man, his home, and his family. Starring Robert Young and Jane Wyatt. Eleanor Donahue, Billy Gray, and Lauren Chapin in Father Knows Best.
There you go. Nothing says Father's Day like a pack of smokes, Roger.
You got that right.
It's Dave Plyer and Josh Plyer live here on Father's Day, as our tradition holds. Good morning again, buddy.
Good morning.
So with today being Father's Day, we're going to take a moment to honor all the fabulous sitcom fathers who filled our TV screens with fumbling moments and fatherly wisdom. And we got a bunch of texts that have already come in here. No matter the time or place, episode to episode, these father figures instilled in us endless life lessons. Do you have a favorite TV dad, Roger Badish?
Yeah, I've got to go with Andy Taylor.
Andy Taylor.
Yeah.
All right, the Andy Griffith
Show.
Because
he was more than just a father.
He was a single dad.
He was a single dad,
yeah,
full-time
yeah.
job,
yeah,
raising a son.
Yeah.
Of course, he had Aunt Bea there and the whole town.
That's true.
To help out.
Yeah.
It was a different kind of dad, different kind of time. But I just loved his laid-back style, the character's laid-back style, and having to deal with life lessons
yeah.
with little Opie, you know. There were a lot of dads that I liked. There were funny ones. There were serious ones. There were kind of cool, laid-back kind of ones.
I have such a variety of texts coming in.
Yeah.
One says Mike Brady from the Brady Bunch. I think that's a given, probably.
Okay.
Tom Corbett from The Courtship of Eddie's Father.
Oh, gosh, yes.
773 Matt LeBlanc on Man with a Plan, Monday, 7:30, Channel 2. Look at that plug.
Little plug. Little must plug work on the show.
He must work on the show, yeah. John Walton of The Waltons.
Yeah, that was a big family.
Is another one. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Stephen Keaton from Family Ties.
I didn't care much for his character, for the character.
Didn't like that as much?
I didn't like the show, to be honest with you. It just wasn't my style.
It's okay. You can have that opinion.
Oh, yes.
Someone mentioned earlier Danny Tanner from Full House. You could tell the generations of when people grew up based on the texts that come in.
Yeah.
What about you, Josh?
Well, we just got a text in that said Howard Cunningham, which I know is your favorite.
Yeah, it is my favorite. It is my favorite. I love that. You know, in fact, there was a great clip, and I'm going to have Curtis play this, of Howard Cunningham when Richie came home in the second season drunk. And, you know, I think we've all had that moment, because I remember that, too, walking in the door and my and not feeling well, and my father tiptoeing into the bathroom, not telling my mother, holding my head as I think I threw up all over the place.
Oh,
so,
my gosh.
But here's a little Howard Cunningham for you. And here it comes. It's coming. He's finding it. Hold on. Stand by. All right. Here's another one that just came into Tom Bradford from Eight is Enough. Lucas McCain from The Rifleman.
Single father.
Archie Bunker.
Yeah.
Josh, what is the other text that just came in from
you? Just got one, Herman Munster.
Kurt, oh, classic. That's great.
I think so. I like Herman Munster as well. You got it? Okay, here's Howard Cunningham.
You're pretty sick, huh, son?
Well, it must have been something I ate. Probably the salami. You never know what they make salami out of, you know, Dad?
Yeah, that's true. Couldn't be that you had too much to drink now, could it?
Oh, that's silly. All we had was some beer and teeny-weeny glasses.
How many teeny-weeny glasses did you have?
72.
So Josh remembers that.
I think it's time for some teeny-weeny cups of coffee.
Yeah, yeah. I share with my family, my kids, these classic TV shows, because I will tell you that if I've said to Josh's friends, hey, did you ever see this show or did you ever see this episode? Mm-hmm. They don't know what I'm talking about. Yeah. They don't watch all this classic stuff. 708, Josh, what do we got there?
Tony Soprano and Don Draper.
Oh, from Mad Men? Oh, God. Draper was terrible. He was a terrible dad on Mad Men. Rob Petrie from the Dick Van Dyke Show is another one here. Let's see here. We were talking a little bit about Ward Cleaver from Leave It to Beaver.
Right.
And there's a great clip of him talking about the difference between fathers and mothers. Let's take a listen. Leave It to Beaver. Ward Cleaver.
You know, Dad, it's funny.
What's funny?
Well, whenever we cook inside, Mom always does the cooking. But whenever we cook outside, you always do it. How come?
Well, it's sort of traditional, I guess. You know, they say a woman's place is in the home, and I suppose as long as she's in the home, she might as well be in the kitchen.
Oh.
Oh, man.
Well, that explains about Mom, but how come you always do the outside cooking?
Well, I'll tell you, son. Women do all right when they have all the modern conveniences.
That's
but
right.
But us men are better at this rugged type of outdoor cooking.
Yeah, right.
Sort of a throwback to caveman days.
Right.
Yeah.
Hand me those asbestos gloves, would you, Molly?
Yeah.
Hand me those asbestos gloves.
It was an oven glove back in the days.
Oh, my God. I would never say that to your mother.
No.
But it was a different day and age.
Oh, my
Seriously.
God. But, I mean, that wasn't that long ago.
No, but it was in the 50s.
It was in
the 50s. And so it was reflective of the times, maybe not necessarily every wife's thoughts.
That's right. Josh, you got some other ones up here. What do you got?
We got Charles from Little House on the Prairie.
Charles Ingalls, yeah.
And then we've got Rick Grimes.
Where's Rick Grimes from?
Is that not Breaking Bad?
Oh, that. Yeah, you look that up.
I've got one I like.
What do you
and this is, again, totally opposite of Andy Amirberry, because this one is very strict.
Yeah.
And, again, a single father, Ben Cartwright.
Oh, you know what? That just came up.
Oh, it did?
That's right.
Read the digits on the code, though, to 708 when you read the text, Josh. Which is the next one?
Next one is Fred Mercury.
McMurray. McMurray.
And
from My Three Sons and Lauren Green from Bonanza. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Rick Grimes was from The Walking Dead.
The Walking Dead. Okay. Yeah. All right. Brian, you're on 720 WGN. You got a favorite TV dad, buddy?
Sure. I just thought of Frank Gallagher from Shameless.
Oh, yeah, okay.
And the reason how I came up with that one real quick, not necessarily my favorite, but you were talking about millennials, Generation X, and things like that. I was thinking more of the newer type of people.
Yeah,
and I like that. It just kind of like rolled with me. I'm like, aha, okay, here's one. I don't think everybody would talk, you know, like the Cosby guy or Danny Tanner, you know, your standard, the Brady Bunch and everything.
We were talking off air, Brian, that there's not a lot of family shows on anymore, especially if you're like really watching Netflix and Amazon Prime and stuff like that. There's not those typical family shows out there. So you got to dig a little deeper, right?
Correct. And I just thought of something kind of different. And also, I want to thank Pat Tomasulo for Man of the People. I was watching that episode tonight, and they were talking about Father's Day cards. And it dawned on me, to me, go downstairs in the refrigerator, get out Dad's chocolate bars, and put them by his laptop so he can have them in the morning.
I like that.
I mean, if it wasn't for watching Man of the People, I would have completely forgot.
Or I would have probably hysterical.
Realized that now that tomorrow's Father's Day, and then, you know, because, you know, I just wanted to be...
Absolutely.
You know, thanks, and you know,
I appreciate it.
That's the only way. Well, like you say, watching Man of the People, you know, tonight, and it made me think, hello, go get the candy bars, bring them upstairs.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a flukish thing, but I appreciate for my airtime.
Thanks, Brian.
Like that, and you guys have a great day.
You too, buddy. Thanks so much for the call. Appreciate it, David. You're on 720 WGN. You got a favorite TV dad?
Yes, good morning to everybody out there. Happy Father's Day.
Good morning. Well. Same to you.
I'll tell you, one of my very favorite dads is Donald Sutherland, the guy who played the dad on Ordinary People. And I was really impressed with the way he handled the family situation, though it was fictional. I mean, it was really quite a situation.
In the movie Ordinary People you're talking about.
Yeah. Yeah, the movie. I think it came out in 1980, but I watched it recently on the movie channel.
Very cool. Yeah, interesting. That's an interesting one.
He was quite a guy.
Yeah, that was very cool. Very interesting. Thanks, David, for the call. I appreciate that. George, you're on 720 WGN. Good morning to you.
Good morning. Al Bundy. Married with children.
I know. You can't get enough of Al Bundy. I know. You know what's funny? It's a show. I don't get to catch that show very often, but he was a funny dad at the very least, right?
Absolutely.
Thanks.
I'm an Uber driver. I got to go here. You have a wonderful day, man.
All right, you too, buddy. Take care. Be safe. All right. Josh, you got another one here. 317?
We got a couple. Well, first we had Rob Petrie from 773.
Yep.
317 is Ray on Everyone Loves Raymond.
Mm-hmm.
And then we've got Tom Bradford on Height Is Enough.
Eight.
Oh, that's eight. My bad.
Need glasses? What's going on there?
We've got 608, Ned Stark.
Henry Mitchell from Dennis the Menace. And then 224, Danny Thomas.
Make Room for Daddy.
Make Room for Daddy. Here's another clip before we go to break real quick of Mike Brady, because, of course, he's a classic. Let's take a listen from the Brady Bunch.
Today is the big day.
Yeah, we got a doubleheader going. Listen, I predict Marcia's going to pass her driver's test with flying colors.
Right, and I predict that Jan's going to do just great in today's debate.
And I predict that you two are great predictors.
Hi, Alex.
Hi.
Now, remember what I said about psyching yourself up, Jan?
Yeah, but I'm still nervous.
Oh, relax, Jan. Women can't be great at everything, but they make wonderful debaters.
Wow.
Whoops. Listen, do you mind if I offer you a suggestion?
Oh, I'll take any advice I can get, Dad.
There is a famous old story about a man who had to get up and speak in front of some very important people, and he was petrified.
I'm with him.
Yeah, but a friend gave him some advice. Says, look, when you get up in front of those VIPs, you picture them sitting there in their underwear.
In their underwear?
Mike, is that true?
That's awesome. A little advice from Mike Brady. Do you remember that episode, Roger? Good morning. Hello.
Yeah. No,
hello.
I'm doing something. Yeah. I did not watch the Brady Bunch.
Oh my gosh!
I'm sorry. I that tic-tac-toe thing at the beginning always kind of freaked me out. And I just couldn't understand how this family could be so almost perfect.
Yeah. I got another one, 815, Brian Keith from Family Affair. You got one, 312-981-7200. More when we come back on 720 WGN. All right, it's Dave and Josh Plyer. We are talking TV's top dads. This is one that several people have brought up, and it's also on our text line as well. There's another one, by the way, 312 Fresh Prince of Bel Air, James Avery. Let's play a little Phil Dunphy talking about being a dad on Modern Family.
It's our parents' anniversary, so we're surprising them with breakfast in bed. They're impossible to buy for, we think. We've never really tried. Okay, ready? One.
They open the bedroom door.
Three. Stop!
And they are in a compromising position.
Oh my goodness.
Nothing's happening!
Oh my god. I can still see it. I can't believe that just happened.
What were they doing?
Nothing.
Whatever it was, it looked like Dad was winning.
Dad was winning. Oh, come on.
Oh my god, that's fantastic.
At the end of that episode, they finally gave them a gift, which was a lock for their door.
Oh, but the, brilliant,
but
yeah.
But the final scene was that every time they're going to lock that door, it makes this huge loud like lock sound that you can hear throughout the house.
So everybody knows they're having sex.
So it locks, it makes that click, and then you see all the kids just look at each other like, oh, geez.
That's fantastic. That's fantastic. Great clip. Josh, you got another text here, buddy?
We got a 630 Archie Bunker.
That's John, yeah.
We got Mike Stivic, the meathead from All in the Family.
Yeah, he was. That's right. He was a dad, too. Let's take a little listen of Archie. I think this is when Archie met Meathead. Let's take a listen.
What kind of a name is Stivic? Huh? Where you from?
Oh, Chicago.
I mean, what's your nationality?
I'm an American.
I mean, where are your people from?
They're from Poland.
I find it funny that that's funny right off the bat.
It's all that.
That would make you Polish then, huh?
Yeah. Anything interesting in the paper?
Yeah, 200 arrested at Vietnam Day peace demonstration. 200. They should have thrown a whole bunch of them in the can. Look at that picture there. Here they are, throwing all kinds of junk and debris at officers of the law. Desecrating on the American flag. The hell of them peace thinks want, anyhow.
Well, I think they just don't like the idea of America fighting an illegal and immoral war.
Well, if they don't like it, they can lump it. Take it down the road and dump it.
Wow.
You say America love it or leave it?
That's right. It's a free country, so am's great.
Well, that would include me too, Mr. Bunker.
Then toodly you to you too.
Well, what would our leaving solve? I mean, with or without protesters, this country would still have the same problems.
What problems?
Well, it's the war, the racial problem, the economic problem, the pollution problem.
Oh, come on, if you want a nitpick.
Nitpick? Let me tell you something, Mr. Bunker.
No, let me tell you something, Mr. Stivic. You are a meathead.
What did you call me?
A meathead. Dead from the neck up. Meathead.
Oh, yeah, now I see what your idea of a free country is. You're free to say anything you want, but if anyone disagrees with you, they're either thrown into jail or called a meathead.
Here it comes.
That's right, because this is American land that I love.
I love it too, Mr. Bunker, and it's because I do that protest when I think things are wrong.
Then stand beside her. And guide her.
The right to dissent is the principle upon which this country was based.
With the light from above.
Listen to me. It's in the Bill of Rights.
From the mountains.
Why do you think we broke away from England
prairies,
to begin with, huh? Because we didn't agree
oceans,
with her. We demanded freedom.
Would fall.
Guys like you who don't God listen to reason. I mean, you're not listening
America,
to anything. And you're totally closed-minded. Not anymore. I'm leaving.
Bless
your president.
America. Get away from me. My home, sweet
home.
Oh, I'm with him on that. All right. Woo! All right. Archie Bunker, everybody. Classic. I got a bunch of other ones here.
Mr. Badish, we've got one more vote for you from 608, Andy Taylor.
Oh, wonderful.
We've got one of the top ones from 419 of Homer Simpson.
Homer Simpson. Good, yeah. Good. Ozzie Nelson, The Adventures of Ozzie and Harriet. Tim Taylor from Home Improvement. Rob Petrie, The Dick Van Dyke Show. Walter White from Breaking Bad. Ward Cleaver. Chester Riley, that's what Carl had mentioned before he left. Life of Riley.
Right.
Let's see here. Jason Seaver from Growing Pains. You really can tell the generations.
Right, who exactly.
George Jefferson.
The Jeffersons. Oh, yeah.
Darren Stevens. Yeah, I guess he was a dad. Darren?
They did have a...
Which Darren? Yeah. That's another joke that... and we have Rich Coase coming up. Triumph the Insult Comic Dog said tonight was, you're not the first Svengoolie, you're the second. You're the second Darren who sucked.
Oh, no.
I'm telling you something. If they rerun the Svengoolies on Saturday morning on Channel 26. You gotta catch it. Let's see here. We talked about courtship. Martin Lane from the Patty Duke Show. Yeah, you could totally tell the generation.
Wow, I'd forgotten about that.
Calling into that a little bit. How about Frank Costanza from Seinfeld? I wouldn't call him the best dad in the world.
How about, and I think he was a single father.
Who's this?
Gidget's father.
Oh, that's right. You're right.
And I think...
By the way, Randy Marsh was from South Park.
I can't remember his name. Now I got to look up the name. But he had two daughters. Gidget was one.
Yeah.
And I don't ever remember seeing the mother.
Oh, yeah. I think you're right
I'm
on
trying
that.
To... let me look
that
it up.
That was a little bit before my time.
Yeah.
You look it up.
A
lot of stuff before my time. All right. We're going to take a quick break when we come back. Rich goes. We'll be right back.
The numbers are in.
WGN Plus is where Chicago comes for podcasts.
Here's what's going on with WGN Plus. Sit Down Stand-Ups wraps their first season of conversations with the one and only WGN's Mike Toomey. Sound Sessions is checking out some brews and bands at the Hideout, and the Mincing Rascals are looking at a recent firing of a weatherman from a news station over a code red weather situation. Look them up on WGN Plus or wherever you get your podcasts.
There you have it. So,
Don Porter played the father in Gidget, and there was a, I'm trying to read real fast, and a widowed father. Yeah, Don Porter.
Is that what it was?
Yeah, and Gidget's older sister, married sister, was Betty Connor, that's who played her. And then Don Porter also played, if I'm not mistaken... I think that was a different one. I'm mixing Hazel with
yes, you are
Gidget, but the father and Hazel.
You're mixing something else in that room.
Oh, would you like to? But the father and Hazel, they also had
there was a couple a child, dads.
Bobby Buntrock, I think, was the kid. That was his name. I think.
Was that your porn name?
Only in the 50s.
What was it? Bobby Buntrock.
Buntrock.
Yeah. Yeah, that's your porn name. That's what I'm gonna call it from now on. Write that down, courtesy. Yeah, all right. Rich Coase and Jim Roaches are walking to the studio. Today is the 40th anniversary of Svengoolie. So please stay tuned. You're going to join us for the next hour. Josh?
The Steve Cochran Show celebrates the most valuable person on the planet. Weekday mornings at 720 on 720 WGN Chicago. Smart speaker users, just say play WGN Radio on TuneIn. It's 3, time for the news with Roger Badish.
Good evening. I'm Jerry G. Bishop, and this is the famed split-level dungeon studio where, many years ago, the legendary Svengoolie burst into television prominence. Even today, many fondly remember Svengoolie providing the same classic entertainment as such time-honored shows as Hello, Larry, My Mother the Car, or Celebrity Pin Spotting. But then, one day, at his peak, Svengoolie simply dropped from sight. The rumors were many. That he'd dyed his hair and changed his name to Phil Donahue. That he'd gone on to a rewarding career in motel management. No one knew for sure. And yet, one rumor still is whispered among an uneasy populace.
What if there were the same situation as in the past with the son of Frankenstein, the son of Dracula, Sanford and Son? Could there exist somewhere, somehow, the son of Svengoolie?
Hey, Dad, can I borrow the keys to the hearse tonight? Yeah! Ah, thank you. Ah, good evening. I am the son of Svengoolie.
Well, I didn't think you were Rula Lenska.
Well, it's an honest mistake. We've got a movie for you tonight that makes Dawn of the Dead look like Godzilla meets the Brady Bunch. Right, guys? Huh?
No.
Well,
sorry.
Well, it's an honest mistake, too. It's called In the Year 2889 and stars Paul Peterson, who used to play the son on the old Don Reed show, huh? Also, it stars such people as Quinn O'Hara, Charla Doherty, and, who else is in this movie?
Rodney Allen Rippey.
And, of course, Rodney Allen Rippey as the asbestos in Tom Snyder's hairdryer. Okay, roll the movie. I'll be back in just a little while. Let's get to the movie now, all right, guys? Thank you. All right, roll the movie. Let's get on with it.
Calling all stations. Clear the air lanes. Clear all air lanes for the big broadcast.
Take two.
It's Dave Plyer and Josh Plyer on 720 WGN. Since his beginnings in broadcasting in Park Ridge, Illinois, not Berwyn.
Berwyn!
Multi-Emmy Award winner, recipient of the Academy of Television Arts and Sciences, Silver Circle Award, Best Horror Host from the Rondo Awards, among others. It was 40 years ago today, June 16, 1979, that Rich hit the airwaves and has entertained generations of fans as Svengoolie. Svengoolie airs every Saturday night at 7 Central on MeTV, and he joins us tonight. Rich, today's the day.
Was it generations or degenerations? I'm not quite sure.
Degenerations. 40 glorious years. Congratulations. And by the way, thanks for handing me the introduction tonight. That was nice.
Yeah, I'm surprised you could read it with my handwriting, but that was so nicely and heartfeltly delivered.
I'm excited.
Thank you so much.
It's 40 years, 40th anniversary. How cool is that?
It's just amazing to me. Yeah. I mean, you know, people always ask me, oh, when you started, did you think that, you know, you were going to be going this long? And it's like, when I got it, the job, I was just happy to have a job.
Yeah.
And I was so thrilled, hey, I'm going to have a TV show. Yeah. And I had no idea how long it was going to last.
Now, Josh Plyer is here with us, too, but so is executive producer Jim Roach. Good evening to you, sir.
Good evening, sir. Thank you for having me.
Nice to have you gentlemen here.
Gentlemen? Who came in?
Of course.
Of course. Oh,
of course. Oh, it never gets old.
It never gets old. You know, we've talked about this before, but because it's your 40th, I want to share with our listeners some of the background on this. Like, you know, what horror movie shows did you grow up with and were you influenced by?
Well, one of the first things I remember that I watched on a regular basis was, I think maybe Channel 5 here in Chicago ran horror movies, including some Universal ones, on Sunday nights.
Hosted?
Like, no.
No.
Just ran the movies.
Okay.
And, of course, Channel 7 had the 3:30 movie where they'd run movies that they had sliced up so terribly, you'd be amazed to be able to follow the plot.
We're talking the afternoon.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, 3:30 in the afternoon.
I watched Ben-Hur over 4 days.
You remember what they said. Love Ben, hated her.
That's right.
But then, as far as hosted stuff, the first thing I ever saw, and I was very, very small, was the original Shock Theater here in Chicago with Terry Bennett as Marvin. And I didn't get to watch that much because, first of all, I was a pretty small kid. But the couple times that we were at relatives' houses and we stayed there late, I got a chance
to see
it.
You got to sneak in a little bit. Yeah.
And I wasn't quite sure what was going on. I was a little confused by it. But then, of course, WGN's Creature Features then. And around the same time was when Jerry G. Bishop started with Screaming Yellow Theater on WFLD.
You're talking about Terry Bennett and Shock Theater. That was ABC 7.
Mm-hmm.
Part of that set eventually became one of the original sets, right?
Yeah. There were a couple of wall pieces that we ended up getting, and I don't even know how, on the Svengoolie, Son of Svengoolie set.
Because everybody threw stuff out. I mean, no one's...
Right,
well,
yeah.
They did and they didn't. They repurposed a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
But where that showed up from?
We have no idea, but it was there. And then after my show there was canceled, it was given to one of the local colleges. And when we were going to start up again at WCIU, I remember calling over to the station and saying, you know, I know you got those pieces. And they went,
Oh, we got rid of those a long time ago. It's like
history.
Okay. Well,
television history.
You know, there
in
you
the toilet again.
If only there was a museum.
If only there was a museum.
If only.
Oh. Well, we will talk about that. You were staff writer for Jerry G. Bishop. That's kind of your connection to original connection to Svengoolie.
Yeah. Basically, he was, you know, reading jokes that people sent him. And this was before it was even a video show. It was like one slide of the title of the show. And he'd read stuff that people sent him or whatever. And I was just a fan of his. I was a fan of his radio stuff, and I enjoyed what he was doing there. And I sent him some jokes, and he liked the jokes. And eventually he found out that I was, you know, a broadcast student. And he came on my little WNUR-FM show,
awesome.
Which was cool.
In Park Ridge, Maine.
And mm-hmm. once I was writing stuff for him, he started to say, you know, hey, could you write me a parody of, you know, this current commercial, or, you know, there's a song that's out now. Can you write a parody of that? And, you know, and
that must have been exciting as hell.
It was. Yeah, I was thrilled. Yeah, and yeah. I, you know, I never had in mind again, you know, that, oh, I'm going to get a job out of this. I was just thrilled that this guy that I really appreciated, you know, appreciated what I was sending him. So it was very cool. And eventually ended up, you know, working with him there. And he paid me out of his own pocket while he was trying to convince wow. the station to pay me, which never happened.
Yeah, gotcha. That's cool, though.
It is. Yeah. And, I mean, it shows the kind of guy he was.
Yeah.
He was always so generous.
But he also had some faith in you that you could do this job.
Well, and that said, he was the one that decided I should be, you know, the next Svengoolie. What happened was one summer.
It was 6 years passed between the time that you played him and he was played by Jerry.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But during that time, when I think it was while we were still at MAQ Radio, somebody had contacted him and said, you know, would you want to just do it as a summertime thing on our station or whatever?
Like the Glenn Campbell Good Time Hour?
Yes, exactly.
Sonny and Cher variety show.
You know, or the Ken Berry Good Time
or
whatever.
Oh, good Lord, whatever it was, yeah.
And Jerry said, you know, I don't know that I really want to do it. One of the reasons was, honest to God, because he thought maybe someday he might want to get involved in politics, and he didn't want whoever his opponent was holding up a picture of Svengoolie and saying, you're going to vote for this man. And
it makes sense. Okay.
And so he said, but you could do it.
But you're running for office now, which is really interesting.
Yes. And yeah. My opponent will hold up a picture and say, he said, you could do it. You know, you could be the son of Svengoolie, and, you know, I'll produce it, and you know, it'd be cool. And we had some false starts on it, and nothing ever happened with it. So when Jerry got his job in San Diego to do a morning show there, and he was leaving, he said, what are you going to do? You know, and I'd been working with him freelance sometimes on some things, and with Dick Orkin, who had also gone out to L.A., and I was still here. And he said, what are you going to do? And I said, well, maybe I'll try to pitch some local station on doing some kind of show. And he said, I tell you what, if you want to try to do the Son of Svengoolie thing, you have my blessing.
That's huge.
It is.
And we opened the conversation playing Jerry's introduction of you from that first episode, which was cool that he did that. But it was kind of a passing the torch.
Yeah, it definitely
was. On the air, yeah.
And as I've said, and what a generous guy he was. He never wanted anything from me for it. He pretty much turned the character over to me and had the faith that I would do a good job with it. I know that he was very proud of what I had done and what I was doing. And
It's phenomenal, fun, vaudevillian, comedy bits, funny. It's so much fun to watch. There's a generation, though, and with all due respect to Jerry, that don't even know there was this other Svengoolie.
No.
They might not even know even of Son of Svengoolie, but you are Svengoolie. I mean,
well,
40 years compared to you. No, but I mean, you really are. That you've really kind of made that character your own early on.
Well, and the reason that I am now called Svengoolie was when I was going to go to WCIU and bring the character back, I was talking to Jerry, who just happened to be in town a little before that, and I said, I'm going to do this, and I said, I'm thinking of maybe trying to shorten the name or something, because people already, even by the time I was done, were going, you're Son of Svengoolie, but who's Svengoolie? And, you know, that's no slam at him, certainly.
Did Jerry appear on Son of Svengoolie or Svengoolie?
He appeared on Son of Svengoolie.
It was Son of Svengoolie.
Yes. He made a cameo appearance.
That's awesome.
There.
I remember that. I just don't remember what era that was.
Yeah.
Okay. All right.
And so he was the one that said, look, you're all grown up. Just be Svengoolie.
Yeah.
And again, what a generous guy. He was perfectly happy with turning the name over to me and very cool.
And it was a Saturday night, right, that you debuted? It was a Saturday night, right?
Originally, a son of Svengoolie?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a Saturday night.
It was a Saturday night.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I still, I would, you know, why can't I find the 3D glasses on eBay? I'd like to know.
Probably people burned them. It's that simple.
You had to bring that up.
Yes.
So are there still any other horror hosts out there?
Oh, yeah, definitely so. There are quite a few, especially on the internet now and on the Roku channels and things like that. And another thing that's kind of cool is since our success nationally, it's kind of encouraged some local stations now to think,
really?
Hey, we could do the same thing. So they brought back hosts in their areas. And I kind of think with our success, it might have also helped people like Joe Bob Briggs get back in the saddle, more or less.
Yeah, and there's others popping up in different parts of the country, and nobody is on a network like Svengoolie is, but there's a bunch of them in smaller markets, and they're coming up, and who knows, they'll be nipping at his heels in no time.
Never as big as this man here.
They're on the internet, and some of them can be seen all over the world, so that's pretty cool.
Very cool. We're going to talk a little bit more with Rich Coase. He's celebrating his 40th anniversary as Svengoolie, and there's more next on 720 WGN.
They did the stomp, Svengoolie stomp, they danced the stomp, Svengoolie stomp, when the moon is full, the mummy stomp.
Dave Plyer on 720 WGN. We're talking to the legendary Rich Coase as he celebrates 40 years as Svengoolie. So I watched the show last night.
Oh, you were the one.
And no, I do watch. I do love the show. And there was something so fabulous that happened. A couple things, actually, that happened on the show. I've got a favorite. But explain to the folks, if you missed it, you can also see it next week.
Yeah. We had an interview that we did with two of the top, you know, voiceover talents in the business right now, Rob Paulsen and Maurice LaMarche. They were Pinky and the Brain.
Yeah.
They've done so many different things. I've never heard anybody do Orson Welles other than
Orson Welles.
Than Maurice LaMarche.
Wow.
He gets it perfectly. And they were two really nice guys and so talented. And they've done tons of cartoons and video games and things like that. And we had a really great conversation with them. And Rob talked about his book that deals with him dealing with, here's a voiceover guy, he had throat cancer.
Oh, man.
And it's an incredible story. And it's just so great that he's recovered and doing well. It was fun to talk to these guys and to know that they know my show.
Yeah, of course.
And in fact, Rob at one point said, thank you so much for always using the little Pinky and the Brain voices in there. Because that
awesome.
Helps keep it alive. And I just was blown away by that.
But you've gotten a lot of really interesting fans over the years that have come out of nowhere that are national. Mark Hamill from Star Wars.
Sure.
Wearing a Svengoolie shirt, which I think we had at the museum exhibit on display.
The picture,
on
that. Yeah.
But you get that all the time. Like, and you, for some reason, are surprised I'm not.
No, well, I'm glad one of us is, because, but yeah, we recently talked to Puddles Pity Party, Puddles the clown who sings.
Tongue twister.
He's a big fan of the show.
That's
got
great.
To visit with him.
Yeah.
He's
of course,
7 feet tall.
Our old pal, Gilbert Gottfried, of course.
Yeah.
And it's just so amazing. I mean, August we'll be seeing Robert Englund, Freddy Krueger.
Cool. Yeah, that's cool.
And he loves the show, and it's just such a great compliment to me.
But the ending is such, first of all, the set is legendary, and we'll talk about that a little bit too, but the end of the show, when the door opens and we're closing out, I know it's my son Alex's, he's 6 years old, that is his favorite part. He's waiting for the hand to come out of that whole thing. This was a very special guest.
Well, most people are happy because it means the show's ending. But yeah, it was so cool. At the door, and I still couldn't figure out how he, you know, operated the doorbell, was Triumph, the insult comic dog, gunned by Robert Smigel.
Yeah.
And he lit into me and our viewers and everything else, and it was just hilarious. It was terrific. He's an old friend of one of our promotion writers, Joe Dale.
Joe, yeah.
And Joe suggested to him, would you want to come in and do it? And he was absolutely going to do it.
Very
he was
excited.
Thrilled. He actually, you know, changed his schedule that day so he could come in. and do it. And he loves local Chicago TV and shows that are done here.
Yeah.
And he was great. He was very funny. There were actually things we could leave in the thing so we didn't have to cut
them. That's good. That's good.
But it was very cool.
And at the end of the show when we had shot this, all of us were just dying. Our ribs were hurting. We were laughing so hard because he just kept going and it was hilarious.
Well, I know he's got like a mental outline that he said he does for something like that, but then he just goes. It just comes naturally to this guy just to spit it all out.
Oh, and he was all over the place. His energy was tremendous.
We have a little audio bite from that. Let's take a listen.
You've done this since 1979, and the wonderful thing about that is he no longer has to spring for makeup to get his eye sockets to look that way.
But that's not really true, Triumph, honestly. Where do you come up with this stuff?
I'm sorry. We all kid. This is a wonderful show. This program has introduced viewers to work that has not seen the light of day, has not even been touched in decades.
Really?
And by that, I mean Svengoolie's teeth. You see, because he's not sanitary.
Wait, I'm not supposed to laugh like that. Sorry. Don't laugh at yourself, ladies and gentlemen.
Fantastic. Oh. Like, it's an honor to even be on your set and throw chickens and do the hand and so forth. And I know there's special guests that randomly do that, but it is. For those who do it, it's an honor to be there.
Well, that's nice to hear. And we do. We have all sorts of people who always are asking, can I come in and throw chickens? Who would have thought that would be something people wanted to do?
That's a thing.
Exactly.
That's a thing here in Chicago. The new set, which is now, 5 years old? Is it 5 years old now?
Yeah.
It was your 35th anniversary, somewhere around there. Because that's when we brought the exhibit, the original set to the museum.
That's when we moved the old one over to storage.
That's right. it is in storage right now, but we'll talk about that a little bit. But that original coffin was Jerry's coffin.
Yes, it was originally his. His first coffin was actually a lay-down one that was like gray wood.
I remember seeing
that. He'd have people who were the guest coffin openers. He'd get celebrities who went to places like Mr. Kelly's and the Blue Max, old nightclubs around here, and he'd have them sign it. And we ended up bringing that once to an appearance I made as Son of Svengoolie at the old Will Rogers Theater.
Wow.
And somehow we never got it back. So I don't know if it's gone or if somebody has it. If anybody knows, contact David Plyer.
312-981-7200 would be great.
But the one that is now in the museum was Jerry's. And when I started, for the first couple of shows, it still had his Svengoolie's face on it. And somebody said, well, you should do something about it. So I painted my face on there.
Right.
And now I paint my face.
But it was a real coffin.
No,
it was always
a set piece. Made by one of the stagehands there, Bobby Walker.
Okay, because when I was over there at the museum with Alex, we were in the back because it's in kind of flux right now until we built the 40th anniversary version of the exhibit for temporary exhibit, and I opened it, and I know very carefully you have to be
you have to
hold it very gently because it's 40 years old.
Yeah, and when they were building that kind of stuff, nobody expected it to last more than a few years.
No.
Who thought that the show would last?
My 6-year-old did ask, is he in there? Like, it's the same question he asked because I've got a genie bottle. He asked the same thing. Is she in there? No.
Tell him I'm in the bottle with her. That would be...
Oh, boy.
Now, personally...
In the bottle again.
Let's start a rumor. I like that. No, but the original set is going to be rebuilt in the fall. We have a rock and politics exhibit called Louder Than Words in there right now. There's going to be a rock and TV exhibit debuting in October, along with a 40th anniversary version of the Svengoolie exhibit. And I believe we're going to be doing an event to celebrate your 40 years, like we did back
great.
In the 35th.
That'll be a lot of fun.
It'll be a great time.
How cool.
As always. Let me ask you, in the last 40 years, what would you say... To you, the top three Universal horror flicks that are your favorites, your personal favorites, and three horror films in general that you would say are your favorite that are outside of the Universal universe?
Well, from the Universal ones, it's kind of a tie for one of them between Frankenstein and Bride of Frankenstein, with Bride of Frankenstein getting a little bit of the edge.
It was freaky, and I remember watching them creature features in the beginning when I saw that woman.
Yeah.
I was like, oh, man, what is this?
Yeah.
And the original Dracula. And then I have to say Creature from the Black Lagoon. I've always loved that movie.
Yeah. We went to see Josh and I, maybe 10, 12 years ago at the Portage Theater when you were there. It was a horror event or convention of some sort where Dracula was playing.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I remember that weeks later, they were playing the werewolf, and Josh would not go because that's the one character that freaked him out. Still today, kind of freaks you out.
It's creepy. He just turns all furry, hairy.
Well, and I think part of that is just the fact that the animalistic savagery of the wolf man.
Done
definitely
so well.
You know, and you're hearing this, you know, they had their throat torn out. And it's like, you know, when you're watching Frankenstein, they're not going, well, you know, he ripped their head off or something.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, they had his throat torn out like by a wolf or an animal. And it's like, oh, man.
No, and usually these shows aired late at night. So now you're dealing with the atmosphere of where you're watching it as well.
Right. Yeah.
And I remember when I was about Josh's age at the time, in the afternoon, when I think it was Channel 7 ran the afternoon horror movies, I was a teenage werewolf.
Oh, yeah.
With Michael, Landon. Doesn't sound scary, but boy, I was
freaky.
Terrified.
Oh, yeah. Especially if like you're in your parents' basement and you're watching no matter what time of day. Oh, yeah.
The werewolf, definitely creepy.
What movie did you have the most fun adding Sven Surround or a big laughs to?
There was a movie that we ran. It was a terrible movie. I think it was called Track of the Vampire.
Wait, what?
Track of the Vampire. And it was a terrible movie. Part of it was made like in some place like Yugoslavia. The other half was made in L.A. And I think neither side knew what the other one was doing. So I hated that movie with a passion. There was like a 7-minute or 5-minute segment where this girl, Dorinda, is dancing on the beach. And they did, a stupid 5-segment thing there with her dancing and like looking through a fly's eye, and it drew flies, believe me. And it was just so awful. And so we decided, okay, we're going to do some things to it. So there was one whole segment where the quote vampire is chasing this girl through the streets. So I redubbed the whole thing, and she was supposed to be a girl who didn't want to go to her swim meet practice, and the other guy was her coach. And chased her all through this. And I'm doing, you know, stupid lines through the whole thing. We doubled it up. And finally they get to the beach where she goes into the water. And there was like a bald guy who's in it. So I made him Curly from the Three Stooges. And so we did that. And then there was a good friend of mine, the late Mike Smith, who was a film editor there. And was quite the conspirator. So at one point he added in just a whole bunch of stuff, all these clips from movies and things. And I believe it was in that movie. And it's all these things. And at one point, there's Liberace going, and thank you very much. It's a wonderful thing to be in Chicago. Cut to Martin and Lewis and Dean Martin going, Chicago? And this went on for maybe about 3 or 4 minutes. And it was all this stuff. And today, I'm sure we could never do anything like that. Simply because, you know, everybody would be suing us for use of their things.
Of course.
But we had a good time with that one.
But that came right to mind. You knew that was the show.
Oh, sure. Yeah.
That's fantastic. Can you stick around? Where else do you have
Where
to go?
Where am I going
to
go? Look at what time it is.
The middle of the night, for God's sake.
What am I going to do?
All right. The Stooges are back on MeTV. We're going to talk about that with Rich Coase, Jim Roach, Josh Player also hanging out as Rich celebrates the 40th anniversary as Sven Gulli. All next on 720 WGN. Dave Plyer back with you on 720 WGN. We are in studio with Rich Coase and Jim Roach. Rich is celebrating 40 years as Sven Gulli, as today is the actual anniversary. Very cool. Josh Plyer also in studio. So you hosted a fine program a few years back called Stoogepalooza.
Yeah.
And the Stooges are back on MeTV. But before we get to that, I don't know if you know about this, but there's an auction house called Nate D. Sanders Auctions in Los Angeles that has secured the personal collection of Mo Howard with items up for auction.
Wow, I just saw a little blurb about that the other day, and I didn't know for sure what exactly it was about.
So everything starts as a bid price of about $400.
Okay.
I guess you could think about the fact that this stuff, a lot of this is from the 30s, 40s, and 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And
sure.
When you think about to own something personal like that, of something that is still in the face of pop culture, two of the things that stood out was
An Ache in Every Steak, yeah.
Is An Ache in Every Steak the original script with Moe's notes
Oh man.
Or the Alphabet song, It's the original sheet music that is handwritten.
Oh man.
I mean, it is just nonstop stuff, and it's a lot of collectible stuff, like promotional items, like grocer's displays for the Three Stooges and stuff. Mm-hmm. But it's not just, you know, I thought some of that stuff when I pulled it up was going to be the Curly Joe Dorita, the late 60s stuff. Mm-hmm. But no, this is like Moe and Shemp era type stuff on here. And then there's original 16mm films with Curly's wedding. On here, the Three Stooges signed contract from 1943 with manager Harry Rahm and Curly's signature on the contract.
Now, do we know where this came from? Was it through his daughter or
from other
relatives?
I'm assuming
it would
be through Joan, who we interviewed some years ago, but it doesn't tell you the origins of all this. It says we have proudly have the collection of Moe Howard. And I think you have to bid by sometime the end of June, but it's a bunch of Columbia contracts on here. Moe Howard's passport. Now, here's what's really funny is the passport picture is Moe and his wife in the picture.
Helen,
Helen. And the minimum bid is $400. There's already a current bid of $1,264 on his passport. Moe Howard signed check to the Curly Howard estate filled out by Moe, and it says estate of Jerome Howard deceased. Mm. So he must have been getting residual checks as a Stooges and then writing his estate for his wife or children or whatever it might have been. I mean, there's the most random stuff on here.
That's pretty amazing.
Moe Howard's agreement with Coney Island Amusement Park for an appearance of the Three Stooges. That might have been Joe Dorita by that point.
It depends on when it was, because they did. I know that with Curly, they made appearances at Coney Island.
Yeah. I mean, it's just some of the stuff is just wild. Yeah, Swing in the Alphabet.
Mm. Oh, man.
It says it's in very good condition. 16 scores total for lyrics and instruments.
Wow.
That's just amazing that this stuff is still around, much less. And the thing is, you know, there's a lot of big names who have big money who I'm sure will be more than happy to keep bidding on this stuff and driving the prices.
What are we going in for?
I would like to get Moe's hairbrush because I figure at this point I could use all the help I could get.
Or just a handful of Larry's hair would be good.
It is the 85th anniversary of the first Columbia short this year.
Yeah.
If there was something from a Stooge short that you would want, what one would it be? What is like your favorite short? That's like, man, if I had to sit down, it was my last day on earth and there's one short I could watch.
I'd want a bottle of Brito.
You know, I saw they sell bottles of Brito. I'm sure
really?
The Stooges estate or whatever, you could buy those. Like you could buy a Brito Beat of Benjamin or whatever.
But an original one from the movie would
be a bottle of Brito. Yeah. But is that your favorite short?
It's one of them. Yeah, I like An Ache in Every Steak.
That's, I think, my favorite. I have to say the Iceman.
Yes.
And it's Alex's too. Alex is like, when we're going through DVRs, is the Iceman on there? And when it comes up, he's like, oh my God, we got to play it. We got to play it.
That is. I like Punch Drunks.
One of the originals from the first,
which is,
I was gonna say, the first season, the first year of Columbia Shorts.
That one's always one of my favorites too.
Jim, what about you? Do you have a favorite?
Three Little Pigskins.
Okay,
that's a good one. Yeah.
Lucille Ball.
There you go.
That's right, I believe.
Well, and the memento that I would like, and I can't remember the short. I'm sure you do. Where Curly is having the oyster soup at the bar.
Oh yeah, sure.
I want the hat he was wearing.
With the tassels on it. Sure.
Where is this stuff?
That's what I want. I mean, the soup is cold by now.
I think ended up just going back into Columbia's wardrobe.
Sure, in the props.
Because I remember they kept all sorts of stuff around. In one of the monkeys episodes, I think Davy is wearing a hat from the 5,000 fingers of Dr. T that we ran on the show. It's like a weird little cap with like a hand on the top.
Yeah.
Still around.
Yeah. So that would have been at least, 15 years after that movie was made?
Well, I guess so. Yeah, back then.
But still, you know, if they kept stuff like that, you can imagine, you know.
But we're talking about some of the stuff, I forbid, is 80, 90 years old.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Does it surprise you with all the vintage vaudevillian acts of that time period that with Laurel and Hardy, the Marx Brothers, Abbott and Costello, a lesser known team, the Ritz Brothers, that the Stooges is still probably the most popular out of all of them today.
It is interesting. I think one of the reasons is the pacing of the shorts. Whereas with Laurel and Hardy, I love Laurel and Hardy, but the pace of their shorts a lot of times is too slow for some people. And they don't really get it. And some of the other teams, I mean, Abbott and Costello are still pretty popular.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, but, you know, like the Ritz brothers and some of these other, Olson and Johnson.
You wouldn't even know they existed.
No, exactly not.
Gone.
And there's just something about, and I think part of it is, you know, Curly's reactions and the character reactions are just so good. You know, going right through to Shemp. Shemp is one of my favorites. He's hilarious.
Unsung. I agree with you 1,000%.
And the other thing, and just the nature of the Stooges material, was shorts.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. To Marx Brothers, which, you know, some would say was superior comedy and more intellectual and more thought out, but you can sit there and watch it, and you could watch them on MeTV on Saturday nights. They do two full-length
shorts.
Yeah,
that's right. That's right. 5 o'clock Central, right?
Yeah. And it's like, it's 15 minutes or 12 minutes or whatever, and you got a whole story. Now, it might not make any sense, but you feel like you've gotten a whole serving. Yeah. And it's always, and as you said, Rich, it's the pacing. It's so quick, and it's just nonstop. It's very frantic, and it's fun to watch.
When you did Stoogeypalooza, the episode that I thought was the funniest, just because of how you structured it, was, oh no, it's Joe.
Yes, where we'd have Joe Besser shorts. And let me say, and I know I've said this before, anytime we would run Joe Besser shorts,
here comes the noise.
There would be hate mail coming in. Yeah. And then, how dare you run him when actually Curly and Shemp are far superior.
I was waiting for the voice.
And there was one guy who would send me an entire email, just line after line after line, going, no, Joe, no, Joe, no, Joe, no, Joe, no, Joe, no, Joe. And I kept wondering, how did he, you know, why did he spend that much time
doing
it? Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, here we go. The cat's
you were angry, eh? Why, I ought to.
I got to be more careful.
More with Rich Coase coming up next on 720 WGN.
Ready, sister? Get that junk out of here. Come on, boys. Scram. I'll give you the idea in a nutshell. B-A Bay. B-E-B. B-I Picky Bye. B-O Boat. I'll give you the correct demonstration. Cutie Pie, pound those horse teeth.
B-A Bay, B-E-B, B-I Bicky Bye, B-O Bo, Bicky Bye Bo, B-U Boo, Bicky Bye Bo Boo. C-H-A, C-E-C, C-I Sicky Sy, C-O So, Sicky Sy So, C-U Sue, Sicky Sy So Sue.
Get the idea, girls? Now we'll all join together on the letter D.
D-A Day, D-E-D.
All right, State Player on 720 WGN. We're talking to Rich Coase, Jim Roach, Josh Plyer in studio. Rich is celebrating 40 years as Svengoolie today. We were talking about the Stooges. About 5 years ago, you and I interviewed Mo Howard's daughter, who has carried her father's torch. She has written best-selling books on her famous dad. How appropriate for Father's Day. Mo's birthday is coming up. It was June 19th.
Mm-hmm.
He would have been 122.
Wow.
If you can believe that.
His hand would be tired from all that slapping.
I would think so. I would think so. But that was a great interview. I mean, it was a great conversation.
It was fun.
We had
and she
her.
Was so nice.
Yes, she was.
What a lovely woman. And you could tell, you know, she didn't get tired of talking about her dad, and you can guess that she's probably been asked a lot of questions over and over again, but she was more than happy to talk about him and very proud of, you know, the family legacy.
Let's hear a little bit of that, her talking about her famous dad and his brothers. So Mo, you know, developed an interest in the movie business really when he was an early teen, and I know he played hooky a lot, and he started his first job in the business running errands at the Vitagraph studio in Brooklyn. And it was during the silent film era. And this is Vitagraph, by the way, was one of the biggest studios of its time. It was started in 1897. It was later sold to Warner Brothers in 1925, big stars of the day. And he was running errands there because he so wanted to be part of the business.
Yeah, I'd heard that story. He started as a delivery boy, and then he'd get roles in these films as a bully. He was like a pint-sized mean Mo from the shorts.
That's funny. In his autobiography, which, by the way, I really enjoyed reading, he talks about getting a job with an acting troupe on a showboat, and what he did was he sent in a picture of an older, handsome neighbor who I guess had done some modeling or something to the captain who was in charge of the showboat show, and I think that really shows how he had such a drive to get into show business.
Exactly, and he got into a little bit of trouble with that because the captain, when he took one look at my dad and realized that he spent all this money on a railroad fare, he handed him a mop and he said, well, at least you can clean the floor. That went on for the first year. And then the next season that he went on the riverboat, he did get a chance to do some parts in the different plays they had.
Well, what's a shame is that all these shorts that he was in the silent era, and actually even the ones that his brother Shemp was in, they're all gone. There was a fire, I think, at the studio at Vitagraph, and all these shorts that he was in are long gone.
Right.
Yeah, that's a bummer.
That was sad. But there's so many things left that we should be thankful for.
Yeah, absolutely. So tell me a little bit about your Uncle Babe, who was Curly, Jerry. You know, he had a bunch of nicknames. Tell me a little bit about Babe.
Let's see. We never called him Curly. Even though he was Uncle Curly or Jerry, I called him what my dad called him, which was Babe. He was the baby in the family, so I called him Uncle Babe. And he was quiet and shy in a family setting. I think my dad must have read him the riot act because...
he had a mouth on him, didn't he?
Yeah, he certainly did. My dad must have said to him, look, you can't do those things in front of the girls. So you better calm down. So there was no real communication. Just, hiya, Joni, and my brother Paul he'd say, hiya, Polly boy. And he'd proceed to, he loved dogs. He had to give them away when he went on tour. But he loved to swim. He'd jump in our pool doing a comedy diving. And when he would, you know, he was pretty heavy. And when he landed in the water doing like a cannonball, half the water would come out of the pool. But as I said, he dressed beautifully, always wore a hat, I guess to cover the bald head. Mm-hmm. Of course, he didn't wear the hat in the pool. But
he didn't like having the bald head, did he? He did. That was for the shtick, but he didn't like it.
Yeah, he didn't care for it at all. And also, he had a wonderful sense of timing. In nightclubs, he'd grab the bass from the club's bass player. Great sense of rhythm. And one of the funny things he used to do, he'd take the tablecloth in the restaurant if he had gone out to dinner, and he'd rip it to the time. To the beat of the music. So if you sat at a table near his, it was really a blast.
I bet. Shemp took over, which was supposed to be temporary, but obviously it was permanent. And Curly appeared in 14 movies, which I don't think people know. They only remember the shorts, but there were some full theatrical movies, but then there was also ones that he just, you know, made appearances in with the boys. 97 Columbia shorts. And then when he was retired already, Joan, he appeared one time only. With Mo and Shemp and Larry. One time that they were all on set, it was the only time. It was a Shemp short called Hold That Lion.
I remember seeing that short. That was really very interesting to see the three brothers together.
Yeah, if I remember correctly, the boys are on the train trying to find the guy that double-crossed him. Maybe it was Mr. Slip. And as they're going along...
Isn't that all of them?
Yeah, probably so. And they're checking out all these passengers. There's one guy who's got his face covered with a newspaper, and they figure, well, this has got to be him. They take it off, and it's Curly with much longer hair than we ever saw him with on screen. He has a clothespin on his nose. And
skinnier.
When they take the clothespin off his nose, he starts snoring and adding in like woo-woo-woo and ruff, ruff type noises. And I remember, I think Shep says something like, yeah, I think he's a Cocker Spaniel or something like that. Yeah.
And Mo said, no, he's just a Spaniel.
Yeah, he's just a Spaniel.
Which I never understood.
I know.
What that meant. But I need an encyclopedia just to understand some of the, the silliness.
You know, they did so many ad-libs. But that was so great to be able to see the brothers together all at once on screen.
And there you have it. What's coming up on Svengoolie?
Well, we've got a really cool Ray Harryhausen movie, The Beast from 20,000 Fathoms, coming up, which I'm really a big fan of. And also a Hammer film. I know you enjoy those.
Yeah, yeah.
It's the Two Faces of... No.
Okay.
You can't touch that.
No, can't touch that.
Two Faces of Dr. Jekyll. Now, we had a Son of Dr. Jekyll movie that we ran a while back. This is full color. It's a Hammer film. It's a very interesting take on Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde in that when he's Dr. Jekyll, he's, you know, more sullen and, you know, lower voice and beard. And when he becomes Mr. Hyde, he's clean shaven and, you know, brighter,
very debonair.
almost more charismatic kind of character. Wow. So it's pretty interesting.
And it's also got Christopher Lee in there as his buddy.
Awesome.
Yes,
awesome.
And then in July we have movies like the ever-popular Mr. Sardonicus.
Nice.
Which a lot of people love.
A classic,
we've got one we've never run before, Curse of the Mummy's Tomb, another one of those Hammer films. And we're repeating the beloved Village of the Giants with young Ron Howard. And,
oh, he's young.
That's oversized awesome. Beau Bridges and several oversized young women.
Like Big John, Little John.
Wow.
And another great classic, Forbidden Planet.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah, that's awesome. Which is such a great movie, and it's so long for our time slot. Mm-hmm. It's more time than we even usually have on air as far as our content. So we're very meticulously trying to pare it down. And also, you know, there's going to be a little less of my material in it just so we can show more of the movie. Yes,
that's nice. You can still buy stuff from that movie, like the robot and everything. It's amazing.
Yeah, there are all
sorts of things. That's lasted.
That's a beloved movie.
Yeah. There was a gift pack that had the DVD of the movie, and it was in a lunchbox, and it had a little Robbie the robot in there.
Oh, I love that. Rich, what are some of the upcoming Svengoolie appearances that are scheduled?
Well, I've been talking far too much, so let's have Mr. Roach here, my executive producer and right hand. And you know how bad my right hand is. Tell us some of the places we'll be, Jim.
Well, I just happen to have all this stuff memorized here, boss. We've got on July 12th, we will be in Schererville, Indiana, beautiful, sunny, historic downtown Schererville, for the Hocus Pocus Party in the Park. And they're going to show the movie Hocus Pocus.
Nice.
And, what's his name here is going to do the intro to that. And but before that, there'll be pictures and autographs and fun for the whole family.
Say, what's his name?
Well, yeah, he's sitting right here. He knows who he is. And then we're coming up for a big thing, which is a big for us every year, the Flashback Weekend in Rosemont.
Yeah, and beginning of August.
That's always a blast.
Second and third. I believe on the second, you'll be joined by another fellow WGN person, Mr. Nick DiGilio.
Yeah, of course.
We're doing it.
That's his thing.
They're
Flashback
doing,
Weekend's
oh,
next
awesome.
Thing. Oh, yeah.
They're going to be doing a very kind thing at the Caddyshack, Murray Brothers restaurant there. They're going to do a special salute to my 40 years.
Oh,
and
that's great.
Nick is going to probably do a little bit of an interview with me there.
Nice.
So we're looking forward to that. And then I'll be at that convention doing my usual signings and taking pictures. That's where we'll see Robert Englund again. We have Bruce Campbell there, Ted Raimi. It's going to be fantastic. Some of the other people from the Elm Street movies, including Amanda Wiss, who is just a sweetheart.
Amazing.
And it's going to be a lot of every year it's a lot of fun.
It's like
and
a reunion, too, of seeing some
up,
friends,
sure.
Right? Yeah, yeah.
And I end up doing the hosting on the costume contest,
of
which
course.
Is Nick's favorite part of it because he likes seeing me being a wisecracker and making up jokes on the spot
that's
about
awesome.
Everything
well,
that goes on there.
Every
awesome.
Every year it gets bigger, too. There's more vendors and celebrities, and it's just it's really a lot of fun, and they really take good care of us out there, so that's fun. Now, one more thing we've got before the end of the summer, since we're plugging ahead the Route 66 Auto Show
That's
on the 24th of August.
Very
in
nice.
Berwyn. Exactly. So there you have it.
And funny how that happens.
Well, I tell you what, they must follow us around. And for all these things, and for more other updated lists about what movies we're running and our other great. Appearances, go to svengoolie.com.
Some T-shirts, some posters, all kinds of great stuff.
There's going to be some special merchandise coming up in a while. There's one big secret that we cannot reveal,
but it's
going to be really big.
Huge.
And of course,
but sign up for the newsletter. You'll find out. Yeah.
Just go to svengoolie.com and you'll find the banner. You can sign up for the newsletter and my blogs. And when, you know, stuff is going to happen, we will always put something in the blog or under the appearances tab there.
And if you look right now on svengoolie.com, there's some information there about a special sale. This is kind of the kickoff to the 40th anniversary celebration.
That's cool.
A lot of stuff coming up.
Is it clearance?
No, Clarence couldn't be here, but it's... Attaboy,
Clarence. Yeah, he got us wings.
But
yeah,
yes, every time you buy a Svengoolie T-shirt, a chicken gets their wings.
with hot sauce, so you know you can't beat that.
All the way from Buffalo. But there's all kinds of stuff. There's the hoodies, the long-sleeve shirts, and other things, some new Universal shirts that are going up there. But all this stuff, there's a special sale going on this weekend and all through to next weekend. So check out Svengoolie.com right now.
Very cool. And, Rich, again, congratulations on 40 years, pal.
Thanks. It only feels like 39.
Rich goes, Jim Roach. Thanks, gentlemen.
Gentlemen?
Who came in?
All right, we'll be right back.
So long, Screwy. See?
Dave and Josh Player back with you here on 720 WGN. Meticulously researched, engagingly present, and richly detailed, the new book Seeking Chicago is truly a must-read for anyone interested in the story of the Windy City and how it got that way. Unlike other books about local history, author Tom Miller reveals the stories of many smaller, more modest buildings that are off the beaten track, the very structures that most guidebooks overlook, along with the iconic landmarks. Chicago is possibly the most important American city for experiencing important architectural masterpieces. And joining us this morning to tell the stories behind the city's buildings and its rich architectural history, Tom Miller joins us this morning. Hey, Tom.
How you doing?
I am fantastic. Thank you for joining us. Also, my son Josh is joining us on this Father's Day, and he'll be heading to the School of the Art Institute to study architecture this fall. And I know the Art Institute is the number one building that you talk about in this book.
It's the first one in there, yeah. It's a beautiful building, and it's interesting how it came to be. The Art Institute, the group, had struggled for years to really get a good museum collection together, and finally they did. They needed a new palace, is what they called it, as a building, and it happened to come along right at the time of the Columbian Exhibition. So they struck a deal with the organizers of the exhibition: if you'll pay half, we'll pay half.
Smart.
You can have an exhibition hall, and then we'll have a permanent museum. So that's how that beautiful, beautiful building came to be.
As we look at architecture in general, what makes architecture such an important part of understanding the city of Chicago?
Well, Chicago, it's very interesting because Chicago was a frontier town, when it started. People here in the north or in the east looked at it as it was a cow town, and actually it was a cow town. That's where it started. So in order to show that they were on a par with Boston and Philadelphia and New York, Chicagoans struggled to make sure that they had buildings that were as impressive and as important as the East Coast buildings. And so we see that in the houses and in the early commercial buildings down in the Loop area, those Romanesque Revival buildings, those big, sturdy buildings. They were all a way that the citizens of Chicago were expressing themselves as important citizens in an important city.
With that said, the buildings and architecture of Chicago have influenced and reflected the history of American architecture. Many refer to the buildings constructed from the 1880s as the Chicago School. Explain what that is.
The Chicago School is sort of a nebulous term, because there is really not what could be called a Chicago style. But what's important about the Chicago School is that it was a group of architects in the Midwest, in Chicago, who looked around at the architecture that America was producing, and that was essentially the East Coast architects. And they said, these are not new ideas. We were regurgitating historic styles. We had Gothic Revival, Romanesque Revival, Renaissance Sure. Revival. You name the revival, that's what we were doing. Louis Sullivan said of McKim, Mead & White, one of the most esteemed architectural firms in the country,
right?
He said, they're not architects, they're copyists.
Oh, man.
So what the Chicago School was, it was a revolution. They said, what we need is new ideas. We need new designs. We need new things. And that's what the Chicago School did. From Chicago, in the middle of the country, it revolutionized architecture across the country, and it changed architecture, American architecture, forever.
Well, we had to make our own imprint on all of this. And you know, as you mentioned, there were cities around the world copying what they saw in other cities. We had to make a name for ourselves here.
Exactly, yeah.
So tell us about the first skyscraper in Chicago.
Well, that was the Home Insurance Building. It was opened in 1885. It was designed by William LeBaron. Jenny, what was important about that was that it was the first steel-framed building in Chicago. You know, skyscraper could not be built until we got the technology of steel framing and the elevator. Those were the two things that we needed. And that's what the the home insurance building had. It was 10 stories tall. It was a skyscraper.
It's huge.
Right. It was the first true skyscraper in Chicago, and that's what makes it important. Unfortunately, it was demolished in 1931 for the field building.
Yeah, I was going to say, was there rules back then as far as, you know, now if there's a building that's going to be demolished that's historic, obviously, you know, it was named a historic place. They get it named so it's not demolished or it could be barely changed. Like, there were really no rules back then. If they decided a building was coming down, the building was coming down.
That's right. There were none. And the only thing until, the 70s, 80s, when they started things like tearing down Penn Station here in New York. But the only things that were really considered historic and worth preservations were either battlefields and sites like that, military sites, or historic houses like a president's house. Otherwise, everything was up for grabs.
The Clarence Buckingham Memorial Fountain. Now, so many people pass by that beautiful fountain that's right on the lakefront every single day. I don't think people understand and know the history of that. Please share that with us.
Probably not. And I think a lot of people consider Buckingham sort of like connected to Britain, Buckingham Palace or some such thing. But it was funded by a woman named Kate Sturgis Buckingham. Her father, Ebenezer Buckingham, had made a fortune in grain silos and banks, and eventually it was Buckingham, who built the Chicago L.
Oh.
So he made millions of dollars.
I would think so, because the same ones are still up.
So when he died, his multi-million-dollar estate was divided among his three children, Kate, Clarence, and Lucy. None of them ever married.
Wow.
So as they one by one died, and eventually leaving only Kate, she became one of the wealthiest women in Chicago. She was not social. She had her name taken off the social register. She spent her entire life improving Chicago by giving money to the Art Institute. She was a patron of more than 200 art students, the Field Museum, things like that.
Wow.
She would never put her name on the donations. She always put them as anonymous in honor of either her brother or sister. And in 1925, she started the Clarence Buckingham Memorial Fountain. So that was a fountain as a memorial to Clarence, her brother. And it was based on the main fountain at Versailles, but it's twice as large. The four bronze seahorses that you see, represent each of the Great Lakes. It cost her, in 1927, when it was completed, $700,000, which is more than $10 million today.
Wow. Wow.
So it was interesting. It's all lit and by colored lights, and she personally oversaw the creation of those lights and the play of the fountain. When that fountain was dedicated, typically of her, there were 50,000 people in attendance that day. John Philip Sousa's band played, and she stayed home. That was
wow.
That was perfectly typical of her. And you know, that fountain is still maintained today by the endowment.
Really?
That she left.
Wow. Yeah. Did not know that. And you know what's really great about this book, Tom, which I really, really enjoy, is that you talk about how much was donated or what it cost to build these buildings back then, but then you put it in today's terms so that you really understand the breadth and depth of how much these buildings cost.
Yeah, I like to do that because, you know, you say, well, this house was built at cost of $30,000. You think, well, that's not so much money. But then when you realize that it's $6.5 million today, that totally makes a difference. Yeah.
Totally true, totally true. The Chicago Water Tower and the pumping station. Now, most people know a little bit about the Water Tower because it's been there. It's kitty corner from Water Tower Place, the shopping center, which is just east of. But the pumping station, I don't think people really understand what the original purpose of that building was.
Yeah, the pumping station, and they actually go hand in glove, if you will. They were built at the same time by the same designer, William W. Boynton, and they're actually in the same style. They're Gothic Revival, but the pumping station was necessary as the population of Chicago grew and grew, and they needed you needed water. And so this pumping station was built there, and it had underground pipes that went 2 miles out into Lake Michigan and sucked in the clean. Can you imagine drinking that water today?
No.
Tetanus shot.
It pulled the lake water out from 2 miles out in the lake, and that was, I forget how many barrels a day that it pumped in, but it still is working as doing that today. I don't know if it comes out of the lake, but it's still working today.
What's amazing to me is that you said, would you drink that water? I probably drink it more today than I would have went back then.
I probably do. Yeah.
And there are many churches featured in the book. Give us some highlights and stories behind them.
Well, there's two that I think are remarkable. One is astoundingly remarkable, and that's Louis Sullivan's 1903 Holy Trinity Orthodox Cathedral on North Levitt Street. And if you know that building, it looks like it was plucked out of, you know, the countryside in Russia. It's a Byzantine Russian country church. It was built for the Russian Orthodox Church with funding from Russia, including Tsar Nicholas II. And the interesting thing is, if you go up close and look at that building, you'll see all of these signature Louis Sullivan details in the architecture, but
beautiful.
He did it.
Yeah, beautiful.
That combined it with this Byzantine Russian country architecture. It's just amazing. And, you know, at the time, 1906 is when that was finished. You think about it, there was a lot going on in Russia at the time, and the priest, Father John Kirchhoff, was transferred back to Russia in 1916 to St. Catherine's Cathedral, and the Bolsheviks dragged him out of the church, out of town, and shot him. So, you know, there was still a very, very close connection between the Russians in Chicago and in the homeland. The other church that I think is astounding is the First Church of Deliverance on South Wabash. That was founded by a black preacher, Clarence Cobbs, in 1929, the congregation was. And he was really quite a character. He was not against drinking or any other vices. He said if God didn't want man to drink whiskey, he wouldn't make it. And
I like that.
In 1939, he commissioned Walter Bailey, the first black architect in Chicago.
That's amazing. That's cool.
Yeah, to design this art modern terracotta-clad church, which really, if you go by it, I don't know if you know that church, it looks like a bus station.
It does.
You know, it does not look like a church. But it is a remarkable piece of architecture with green stripes and the cream-colored terracotta tiles. That was quite a congregation, still is, but of course we don't have Preacher Cobbs, as he was called. At one point he did a mass baptism in Lake Michigan with 41 members, while 10,000 members looked on. And I remember once in 1952, he had to give a eulogy at the funeral of one of his members who was a gangster. And he was involved in all sorts of crimes. And
there was gangsters in Chicago? Are you saying that? Are you making a statement?
Yeah, imagine that. Preacher Cobb, in his eulogy, he sort of tiptoed along that little line there, and he said, the Theodore Rowe, he wasn't going to go to heaven, but you know what? He's not going to go to hell. His spirit will just go to the waiting room.
Nice. I like that. I like that. We just moved out of the Tribune Tower, where we were on and off for decades. It's currently under renovation and repair. If you saw some of the pictures that people have been posting, they've literally blown out sides of the building. It's mind-blowing to me. And I know they're also power washing the building and doing other things, but I mean they're doing some serious work. I mean it's down to really the framework, the original framework of the building. But share a little history about this building, because it's such an important piece of Chicago history.
It certainly is. And you know, that was the Tribune had a contest in 1922 among architects for a winning design, and two New York architects, Raymond Hood and John Mead Howells, who had gone to school together. Howells convinced Hood to join this contest, and he really hadn't really done anything to speak of. Hood had not. Turns out that they won the contest, and they made this building, this neo-Gothic terracotta-clad building, this impressive, impressive building. And interesting about this building is that Robert Rutherford McCormick, you know, the owner and publisher, who was quite a character in himself, as this building was being planned, he had all his foreign correspondents all over the world send back rocks and masonry bits from historic sites. I'm not quite sure how they got all of those, because some of them were actually from buildings, like castles and things. But all of those little rocks and bits were incorporated in the street-level facade, and they were all labeled. So if you go by very closely, assuming they put everything back like it was, you can see all these little rocks and things from the Wailing Wall in Israel. They're beautiful. Like that.
You could spend hours walking around that building and studying it and just finding amazing pieces that you didn't know existed. I'm sure there's thousands of people that walk by there, hundreds of people walk by there a day that have no idea.
They have no idea. You're absolutely right. Yeah. Because that's what we do. We tend to go about our business on the same track that we always ride. And we just don't ever stop to look left, right, or up.
That's true. That's true. You have one fire station featured in the book. It's Engine Company 98.
Yeah, that's very close to the pumping station. And what's interesting is that it's in the very same style, although it was built, geez, half a century later. It was completed in 1904, designed by Charles Herman. It's a little neo-Gothic building. Looks like a little castle. And it's really a charming, charming building. Of course, it was built for one horse-drawn engine, you know. And the amazing thing about that little building that I love is that it's still a functioning fire station. It doesn't have a horse-drawn engine anymore. It's got, a motorized one now.
Right, yeah.
But it's such a charming, charming building. It just looks like a little castle sitting there.
And I must ask, in your opinion, what do you think the most underrated building in the city is?
You know, that is hard to choose, but I think if I had to choose one, it would be Burnham Brothers Carbon and Carbide Building on North Michigan Avenue.
Yeah, yeah. It's a very, very cool-looking building. Absolutely.
It is an Art Deco jewel. It's all this dark green terracotta and black granite, and it is just a jewel. And you just don't hear anyone talk about that building, and it's a really, really special piece of architecture.
Well, this is a great book. It's called Seeking Chicago. Tom Miller's the author. It is a great gift for Father's Day. So pick it up today wherever books are sold. Tom, really great book. Again, love the images in there. Love the stories that you tell. Love the financial background, the stories of the people around it, the architects themselves. Really a terrific book.
Well, thank you, and happy Father's Day.
Same to you. Enjoy your Sunday, sir.
Okay, bye-bye.
All right, top stories are next on 720 WGN.
And good morning to you once again, Josh Plyer.
Morning, Dad.
It was great having you in the studio on another Father's Day. You know I love this tradition and tradition in general, so thanks again for being here.
No problem.
I think we're going to visit with my father today, probably Grandma too, but right. With Grandpa. And then up in Polish Fest, maybe in Wisconsin.
Sure.
Maybe that we'll do that, a little adventure after we get in a little napping.
Yes, please.
Here are some other things happening in the city that you can do with your dad or grandfather today. I know this one is you're going to get a kick out of because your little brother's going to want to do this. There's a Pokemon Go Fest in Grant Park.
Of course there is.
Do you know about this?
No, I have not.
So it's working together not only with the thousands of trainers in the park, but also millions of trainers around the world. What do they mean by trainers?
So Pokemon Go is an app where you're a Pokemon trainer yourself, and you're catching Pokemon all over the city or wherever you're at. It could be all over the country. It's a map where you are and where Pokemon are. Once you get in the area of that Pokemon, you can slide up and swipe a Pokeball at it, and if you capture it, then it's in your inventory. It was huge a couple of years ago, and then it got annoying, and kids were starting to compete, and then there's...
All right, let's just skip that this year. Sure. All right. there's a couple things going on in Chicago. Now, I mentioned Polish Fest up in Milwaukee, which we've gone to. There's also Rib Fest in Chicago. I know. I know. We got to think about doing that. Taste of Randolph also going on. Pilsen's Taco Fest going on. Right. We might have to stay in the city for this.
A lot of food.
There's also goat yoga at the Garfield Park Conservatory. Get ready for goat yoga. We're excited to host, it says here, a special session of yoga with our visiting kid goats and our fantastic yoga instructor.
In between innings at Wrigley, when I work there, between innings they'll show like a couple of advertisements for their sponsors or whoever. I for some reason I've been seeing these clips of goats walking on people in yoga positions. So I feel
I bet you that's from there.
I feel like that is from that.
So ribs are Polish. We're gonna have to ponder that. Let's get started with This Is History.
Ask not.
The Beatles.
Circus is on the air.
And the president doesn't.
Sometimes you feel like a...
That means that it is not illegal.
Sometimes you don't.
Tear down this wall.
Here's Jennings.
Hey, Luke. May the force be with you.
It was you, Kristen, who shot J.R.
I did not have sexual relations with that woman.
Ah! We're not gay. Not that there's anything wrong with that.
John's been waiting a long time to take the reins.
My name is Dave Letterman. Last night, I became a father. Thank you very much.
Today, Apple is going to reinvent the phone.
George W. Bush, and I approve this message.
For the third time in six seasons, it's one goal achieved. The Chicago Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup. The Blackhawks win the Stanley Cup.
It's in time. And the Chicago Cubs win the World Series. The Cubs have done it.
And now, this is history.
You're going to need outstanding hosts.
With Dave Plyer.
It's a guy, but I love you.
And Dave Schwann on 720 WGN.
So 1868, President Andrew Johnson passed a law that government workers could work an eight-hour workday. In 1864, the eight-hour workday became the central demand of the Chicago labor movement. The Illinois legislature passed a law in early 1867 granting an eight-hour day that was largely ineffective. But there was a strike, and it shut down the city's economy for a week before it collapsed. And in June 1868, Congress passed a law for federal employees, which was also of limited effectiveness, but it at least got the conversation going because people were working 10, 12, 14-hour workdays.
And 6 days a week.
And 6 days a week. See, Josh, you got it easy.
Boy, oh boy, I'll say.
Back in my day.
I'll say. Chicago really played a very important part in what resulted in the five-day, 40-hour work week.
Yeah. Yep, the Chicago labor movement right there. Mm-hmm. Yep. 1892, the first L, Chicago and Southside Rapid Transit Railroad began revenue service in June of 1892 when a steam locomotive pulling four wooden coaches carrying over a dozen people departed the 39th Street Station, arrived at the Congress Street Terminal 14 minutes later over tracks that are still in use today by the Green Line.
Wow. Can you imagine a steam locomotive?
Yeah, crazy, right?
In the middle of all the skyscrapers?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah, it was pretty
I've seen
dirty
pictures
back then.
Of that. Yeah. I've seen pictures of that. And that's all that, you know, there was the electric, standard electricity that we have now that runs those trains. It wasn't around.
No, it was not around at that time. 1910, Father's Day celebrated for the first time in Spokane, Washington.
That's right.
In the YMCA in 1910 by Sonora Smart Dodd, who was born in Arkansas, and his first celebration was at the YMCA on June 19th, 1910. Her father, the Civil War veteran, William Jackson Smart, was a single parent who raised six children there. And after hearing a sermon about Jarvis's Mother's Day in 1909, she told her pastor that fathers should have a similar holiday. And she initially suggested June 5th. Her father's birthday, but the pastors didn't have enough time to prepare their sermons, so it was deferred to the third Sunday in June.
And here we are,
1910 on that one. 1917, the Raggedy Ann doll was invented. 1933, Don McNeil's Pepper Pot Breakfast Club began. It's, and this is unprecedented when I think about this, 35-and-a-half-year run on NBC.
You know, I still have a memory of Don McNeil's Breakfast Club on the radio. And you know who carried it?
Who?
WLS.
Yeah, it was NBC first on the Blue Network and then mm-hmm. ABC Radio and then a little bit on television, I think, from
yes.
Chicago here, right?
Yep, yep.
June 33 to December 68, McNeil's 35-and-a-half-year run as host remains the longest tenure
for an MC of a network entertainment program, surpassing Johnny Carson, 29 and a half years, Bob Barker, 34 and two-thirds of a year on The Price is Right.
Two-thirds of a year.
Yeah. That's what they wrote here. There's not a lot of audio left of the show. Let's take a little listen to the clip from Don McNeil's Breakfast Club.
Presenting America's favorite, the Blue Network Breakfast Club with Don McNeil.
Good morning, Breakfast Club. Good morning to you. We got up bright and early, just howdy to you. The coffee's on, the table set, there's bacon in the skillet. And Harry Cogan and his boys have fumes to fill it. So come on, gang, and gather around. We'll start this meeting. Just line up here. I'll call your names and sing your greeting. Marion May.
You could totally tell that is the 1930s for sure. Just the music alone.
You
should sing your news today, Dave, just in honor of the Breakfast Club.
Excessive heat warning in effect today.
Yeah, I wouldn't do that. All right, so anyway, 1940.
No, I think that's a good idea. Just stop.
Batman comics. Mobsters rubbed out a circus highwire team known as the Flying Graysons, leaving their son Dick an orphan, thus the introduction of Robin in all this. That was Robin. It was Robin. It was not the Batman comics introduced. It was Robin, how he was introduced. So, mobsters rubbed out a circus highwire team known as the Flying Graysons, which included his parents, and Dick was an orphan. So, what's his name now?
Bruce Wayne.
Took him in. Yeah. 1949, Captain Video and his Video Rangers debuted on DuMont Television, which was Channel 9 here in Chicago. Let's take a listen.
Post, P-O-S-T, P-O-S-T, the cereals you like the most. The cereals made by Post take you to the secret mountain retreat of Captain Video, Master of Space, Hero of Science, Captain of the Video Rangers.
There you have it. But that's not my favorite memory of Captain Video and the Video Rangers. It was the episode of The Honeymooners, the first of the 39, where Ralph and Norton were sharing a TV, and Norton was watching his show and woke up Ralph. Let's take a listen.
Attention, Rangers! I want all you Rangers at home to recite the Captain Video Ranger pledge. Hi, Edward Norton. Ranger, third class, and I cut the video space economy to solemnly pledge to obey my mommy and daddy. Be kind to dumb animals and old ladies in and out of space. Not to feed my little brothers and sisters, and to brush my teeth twice a day and drink milk after every meal.
All right, that's it. All right, out!
He grabbed his helmet.
I can picture this.
Right? I can do. What was that?
From the sewers.
That's right. Yeah. I'm telling you. But Josh, you know the Honeymooners.
Oh yeah.
See, but how many kids could you ask your friends if they've ever seen the Honeymooners? Really, and I'm asking honestly, would some of them know?
Maybe,
but not many.
Be too familiar.
They've been on syndication and reruns long enough.
But you know what? They're not as visible. Like, you know, MeTV, you have to go find it and watch it to do that. And I don't know if a lot of kids do that. Like, my daughter sees it, too. I don't think Alex, my youngest, has ever seen it. 1955, first automobile seatbelt legislation was enacted in Illinois. That's where it started again. And seatbelts were a must. Although, my grandmother, I remember, in her 1960 Chevy Impala, just used to put her hand in front of me.
You still do that to me.
I still do that as a joke to him. But
I remember cars without
seatbelts. That was her seatbelt. Yeah,
I remember cars that just didn't have them.
Oh yeah, that my grandma's car didn't have one. Yeah,
our very first car that I have a memory of was a 1955 Chevy Bel Air. It was one of the classic mid-1950s cars, you know, those big
boats. Those are beautiful. I know, with the cone
lights. You sat up high, and the steering wheel was huge. But there were no seatbelts in that, and I don't think there were seatbelts in the car Dad got after that one.
Probably not.
So, that was a 1960-61 Oldsmobile.
65, first U.S. ground forces in Vietnam, authorized by President Johnson.
This is a different kind of war. There are no marching armies or solemn declarations. Some citizens of South Vietnam, at times with understandable grievances, have joined in the attack on their own government. But we must not let this mask the central fact that this is really war. It is guided by North Vietnam and it is spurred by Communist China. Its goal is to conquer the South, to defeat American power, and to extend the Asiatic dominion of communism. And there are great stakes in the balance. Most of the non-communist nations of Asia cannot by themselves and alone resist the growing might and the grasping ambition of Asian communism. Our power, therefore, is a very vital shield. If we are driven from the field in Vietnam, then no nation can ever again have the same confidence in American promise or in American protection.
1980, the David Letterman Show debuted his short-lived talk show on NBC Daytime before Late Night premiered, and they premiered, and actually this week, Late Night with David Letterman aired for the last time on NBC in 1993 before he moved to CBS.
Welcome to the program, ladies and gentlemen. You are looking at a very excited, very happy man. Listen to this. Earlier today, for the first time, NBC named me Employee of the Month. I was thinking about something. If General Electric, the vast global consortium which owns NBC, if GE had a sense of humor, they'd send a guy in here right now to fire me.
Remember something? And you're fired.
So this is our 1,809th and final show for NBC. We began the program cold day in February of 82, and here we are in the middle of June, a lovely summer evening in 93, nearly 11 and a half years, and we're wrapping it up. I want to thank the folks at home who have watched us all those years. It seems unlikely that we would get together and do this every day if you folks weren't at home watching. You know. The next time we see you, folks, it will be Monday night, August 30th at 11:30. Have a good night. Thank you. Goodbye.